Hello, welcome to the first Chapter Readings podcast. Chapter readings are a series of events celebrating the beauty and significance of the written word spoken aloud. Each month, an artist or a group of artists will design a literature-inspired reading created from a single theme or idea at the Chapter Arts Centre in Cardiff. The project is developed and curated by Be Aware Productions as part of Chapter's Associate Artist Programme, Paylot. I am Mehmet Ali Alabora from Be Aware Productions. The first reading you're going to listen to is designed by Philip McKenzie based on theme of The First Time. McKenzie invited four writers and a performer to join him for the evening. All pieces are read by their authors. The first one is a short story by Ronnie Pope, Work Back from Blindness. Second short story is by Peter Brooks, A Celebrity First. The third piece is by Malte Marikan, an excerpt from her play Hon. Pınar Öğün joins Malte Marikan to read the text. Philip McKenzie reads four pieces, all written by himself, and this is the first time he shares his writing. The last piece of the evening is by Eric Nigal Charles, Death on the Third Floor. The sound design is by John Rea. The reading was recorded live on April the 3rd, 2018 at the Chapter Arts Centre in Cardiff. Hope you enjoy.
An invocation. Oh, triple form of darkness, your somber splendor, a moon of unseen men of gentle spring. Let me, the offering, bring to you sepulchral glittering. I bestow the bloom sown in the dusk and gathered in the gloom under the waning moon. At midnight, hardly lighting the east, I bring and stir the slow infernal tune. Here, where the band of ocean breaks the road, black trodden, deeply stooping to the abyss, I will salute you with a nameless kiss which glitters in the mist. A sleepy and reluctant river, even as you draw. Keep your eyes on mine. Come to me across the sense-bewildering flood that holds my soul forever. She answered the buttercup yellow door. She was my great-grandmother and was already 96 years old. A ray of light reached through the stained glass window in the hallway. It illuminated her, and for a moment she resembled an azure figure of Mary Magdalen. I felt the mid-afternoon sun kiss the top of my spine. Under oath to the blackbirds and the birch trees, I was invited in and told that Mars had grown large in the sky that autumn. The house was tall. The top floor had been converted into a flat in 1970-something, but nobody had ever lived in it. The orange wallpaper, the teak, and numerous sideboards, the scratchy apricot wall. It would be my home for the coming weeks. I laid out my belongings on the bed. Three polo neck jumpers, one pair of racing green gloves, a small bronze coin bearing the head of some unsung hero, and a silk scarf that belonged to my mother. I took a shower and offered to head to the market to get something to eat for tea. She requested that I acquire peaches and pink grapefruit for breakfast. I knew that her peripheral vision was deteriorating, though she was dexterous in feeling her way around each room. Her bedroom was on the ground floor, a small powder pink room with curtains that dance in the breeze. The washroom was a short walk away at the end of the garden. I enjoyed exploring each room beyond the nettles and the undergrowth, and there was only one part of the house that I was forbidden to investigate, a single room on the first floor. I refrained from asking any questions. perhaps out of politeness or because of some underlying fear. She had a telling, an undeniable wisdom to her lined face that signified a decisiveness, an untradable eloquence, an unconditional trust. Over the course of the first fortnight that I had stayed, she poured cups of tea that tasted strange and would leave my mouth dry. I would sip them nonetheless, as she would observe me closely until the teacup was empty. It would be then taken from my hands and she would hold it approximately 6 centimeters away from her nose. Humming and muttering, I'd be asked for the back of my hand, upon which she would pour the remnants. A test. She never told me what she had seen, or what she thought of what she saw, but these musings were penned in deep blue ink in a bound notebook of meadowsweet paper embossed with gold leaf. Sent into a reverie by these strange-tasting cups of tea, I often recalled some of the stories about her that my father had told me. Up until she was 85, she and her husband had led groups of young walkers deep into the mountains of Tyrol and across the granite landscape of Dartmoor. They would speak kind words to the heather and swim in the black streams. All this took place after she was washed ashore, weighted down by tins of condensed milk, after leaping from a sinking boat returning from India. She collected pin badges on her travels. When I re-emerged from this state of detachment, I was presented with a list of tasks. I built and lit the fire in the hearth, and I sat prodding it for a while, finding pleasure in feeling the heat pull my face taut. Next, I gathered herbs from the garden, watered them, and trimmed them, predominantly mint. Then, I rooted around for a stepladder and cleaned the windows on every floor, but the first. I had finished soon after noon. At around 2 o'clock, I knew that a boiled egg would appear. I'd tap it with the beck of a tarnished spoon, and she'd suggest that we read for an hour or two. The sun beamed golden, lucid, unapologetically spilling into the front room. I asked if she'd mind if I took her photograph. We smiled. I unwrapped the camera that was swaddled in cloth, buried in my bag, and found her in soft focus. When the inky shroud of night sky emerged, it took to covering the day like silk. The date that I would move on was fast approaching. She told me that she'd ring a bell on the first floor this evening, and that I should hurry to her the second I heard it. My subconscious began to stir, worried about the formality of this occurrence. Still, I asked no questions. When the bell eventually sounded, I did as she'd asked, only to be sent back upstairs with instructions to wear a dress and to let my hair fall about my ribcage. Again, I asked no questions, despite having only packed 2 white nightdresses. Perhaps if I pruned the bunch of flowers that was in my bedroom with a pair of nail scissors and wove them into some sort of prodigious corsage, and then layered a great lace drape from above the window, I could fashion some kind of suitable garment. My arms felt cold and bare, but she seemed to find my outfit both pleasing and amusing. I can't say that I had heard the front door welcome in any visitors, but for some strange reason I was expecting guests. I can't say that I'd heard any movement in the kitchen either, but I remember thinking of food and of wine. She pushed open the door to the second room on the left. And this was when she made her plan known. The floorboards were stained a dark shade of hazel, and a white circle was drawn in the centre of the room. I saw the artist's instrument. A stick of chalk attached to a length of twine. I was seated in the circle and introduced to a small plate of buttery cakes and white grapes. My great-grandmother, who I now recognise was the master of ceremonies, prepared by lacing up her shoes, sprinkling the peripheries of the room with a small amount of salt, and rearranging all 22 candlesticks. I sat still, in silence, mesmerized and a little confused. The invocation began, and my throat began to ache a little as the wind spoke rumors of blowing cold. Mimosa. The smell of mimosa. The pages in her shadowed book began to turn, summoning the song of three nightingales, soft, brown and tawny. The wine rose and the candles burnt their wax, black, dripping, thick as velvet cloaks, crimson, travelling without a compass, ambit and amplitude, like a herd of planetary horses, hooves and feathers, through time, through space, sang with the pipe player on the street and the demand for fresh fruit. Working back from blindness, I now realized that my first spell was cast. Forever intrigued with circularity and sacrifice, my great-grandmother, Lucretia, lived to be 102. She left me a poem. As I was walking along the beach one day, the waves came rolling in as if they wanted to snatch me away and take me away with them. They rolled until they came up to me as if they wanted to play. They seemed to say, "Come with me, and we'll show you the way."
Summer landed on my doormat today, an old postcard of the M40 just before it opened. Friend Richard. He knew no dreaming spires or misty meadows would drag me away from my sad London basement, but maybe a road, an empty road. "Here comes the sun. Get outside, man. Why don't you come up? You can help us finish the set, take in the opening, and then party. Arabella sends kisses. Rich." I'd planned to spend the weekend in bed, licking the wounds of another lost love. By the time I'd finished breakfast, this seemed like a better idea. An impatient taxi waited in the street. As I drew up behind, the front door of the house flew open, and four of them skipped down the pathway. Richard spotted my car and came over. I lowered the window. "Thought I'd accept your invitation." "Why didn't you let us know?" "No phone, no time." "We're off to the Friday Film Club, Red River. Coming?" "Seen it. Anyway, I'm whacked." "Here, have my keys, food in the fridge, bikes in the backyard. Help yourself." "Bikes? Why not? Town is downhill all the way." "Ah, I just want to crash." "Okay, you're on the top floor next to the bathroom, the one with the teddy on the bed." "Teddy? Arabella's idea, I told you. She likes you. Probably wants to swap with it later." "Oh, that's nice. I hope she can wait till the morning." "If you're in the mood, there's a late-night bar called the Dog and Duck in a back street behind the Playhouse. Just make sure you get there before 10:30. "It's nearly 10 now. We'll make up your mind quick." After installing myself in the teddy bear room, I scrubbed up and perked up and decided to leap on a bike. I had an A to Z and a copy of Sons and Lovers in my pockets. The Dog and Duck greeted me with heavy-duty bouncer, crowded lobby and po-faced landlord. After squeezing through that lot, everything was fine. I ordered a beer and headed for an empty corner table. Sons and Lovers came out, and I pretended to read, all the while casting glances round the room. My eyes landed on a woman, mid-40s maybe, perched on a stool at the end of the bar. I recognised her. She was wearing all white, cotton dress, chiffon scarf, straw hat and sunglasses. Obviously drunk, she was entertaining the other barflies with theatrical tales. I stared, trying to remember her name. Fragments of her films came back. I could picture her in them, oh so English little numbers that took off in the States. She caught my stare and returned it. I swallowed hard and let my eyes stay fixed on hers. Next thing, she picked up her bottle and glass, slipped off the bar stool and wobbled over in my direction. What are you reading? I raised the book. Good choice. You look rather Laurentian. I do. Yes, I mean, collarless shirt, silk scarf, waistcoat, and that stupid cap. Take it off. Okay. Much better. You look rather famous, even with that floppy hat and the shades. What are you doing wearing sunglasses at night? Take them off. She laughed and complied. Much better. For the next hour or so, I struggled to hitch a ride on her short wavelength, up and down ways. 1 minute she was slithering down the bench seat and taking a slow-mo puff on her cigarette with her eyes half closed. The next she was sat bolt upright, flicking her hair back with her fingers, talking non-stop and flirting outrageously. She knew what she was doing, though, and I, 20 years younger, certainly didn't. When she asked me to take her home, I hesitated. All I could think about was the fucking bike. Sure, but I need to get my car, like it was in a multi-story or something. I'll pick you up in 10 minutes. Bet you don't come back. Bet you're not here when I do. I raced uphill, swapped conveyances, and returned in 20. She was still there, slumped in the corner, fending off a fan. When she saw me, she held out a floppy hand and let me do the rest. Her apartment was an elegant first floor in a Victorian mansion block, the air sickly sweet with the scent of longiflorum lilies. It's not mine, I'm here doing rep. Do you want something to eat? I'm famished. I declined and watched her fish from the freezer a bird's eye cod in parsley sauce. It was perfectly square. How can fish be square? She threw some tin French beans in a pan with the boil in the bag fish and then ate the lot while I went off the boil. Without a word, she disappeared, returning minutes later in a satiny nightgown. She curled a little finger at me and I followed her to the bedroom. Once under the covers, we rolled around a bit until I found myself in place. But by now she was heading for oblivion, and with a prolonged out-breath of boiled cod, Bordeaux Blanc and Balkan Sopranis, appeared to pass out. I went to extricate myself, but she wrapped her arms around my back and clamped my ankles with hers. Duty called. I thought of the grandchildren to come. Gather round, kids, while I tell you the story of the time I made love to a famous film star. Maybe not. At least she relaxed her grip. On my way out, I looked around the sitting room. A swollen purse, photos galore, and trinkets beckoned from the sideboard. But I wanted to leave her something of mine, not take something of hers. I snapped off a lily, tucked it inside my cap, and left them on the dining table. Back at the house, the four were lying around smoking weed and going on about auteur theory, camera angles, and denouement. Richard looked up. So, where'd you go? What have you been up to? You'll never believe this.
My story begins on a Monday in July 2013 with my arrival at Cardiff Central Station. I had Pınar with me. We left in a night with a single suitcase and came to Wales. Of course, I had never imagined our arrival in Cardiff to be like this, bitter, broken, and incomplete.
I have never been a woman who could hide her feelings, so much so that Madam, who is like a sister to me, always tells me off for exaggerating. But in fact, she has always been like a locked box, Most of the time, it is impossible to understand what is happening inside of her. Even though she doesn't really say much, when we are together, I always have something to tell her. But for the first time in our lives, during our 20 hours journey to Cardiff, I didn't speak a word either. Try as she might to hide it, she couldn't walk without limping.
Wales! Cardiff!
Yes, Cardiff.
We are safe now.
But we have nowhere to stay.
Don't worry, we'll find somewhere to stay sooner or later.
Maltam, I know you are in a lot of pain. Why don't you sit at that pub over there? Then I can leave the suitcases with you and look for a hotel.
Doop, 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 doop.
Maltam, are you okay?
Okay, okay, go.
You sure?
Definitely, I'm sure.
In a city I don't know, I become stock still just like that. I'm very nervy, very upset. My mind is back at home with my husband, Mehmet Ali. When I left the house with my suitcase, Maltam being with me was the pillar of my strength. Nothing would go wrong as long as she was with me. The moment we came out from the Cardiff station, Maltam, the pillar of my strength, turned into a completely different woman. It was as if something haunted her. Could cities change people? Could a person change as soon as stepping into a city? Could souls change according to cities? It was as if Maltam, whom I'd known very well since I was 19, was gone, her body possessed by the disembodied soul of a Welsh person waiting at the station. Could this be real? Could this disembodied souls hovering over cities be waiting for the right possession? It can't be. Of course it can't possibly be. But then how is it that this woman, whom I believe to be merciless rationalist, could all of a sudden become this happy and peaceful and maybe just a little bit dumb? I'm really going to lose it.
For years, I established a completeness in my inner world with all my broken fragments. My motto is, whatever the situation is, it must be acknowledged. This way, the situation turns into a playground to fight the obstacles. That's why I adapted myself to every situation in order to survive, in order to find balance in my inner world. That's why I have never complained, but always fought. It hurt me, for sure, but I learned to build completeness from my broken fragments without expectations, static, distant, living more and more introverted. But as soon as I step out from Cardiff station, that completeness was demolished. It was as if all of a sudden something clicked. I don't know how to deal with this joyful feeling and peaceful state of mind that conquered me. How can I explain all these to Puna when I do not know how? Listen, my lovely Puna, just like that, all of a sudden...
The hotels are full. I can't find anywhere to stay. And I'm getting more and more frustrated. The more I get angry, the more I lose my English. I want to understand. I have to understand how Maltam has suddenly changed. Otherwise, I might not be able to cope with this. I know she's obsessed with Wales. I was the one who said, we will move to Wales together without even thinking about it. when she decided to move here years ago. But in these circumstances, I'm sorry, but I don't get her state of mind right now. My family, just like Meltem's, had migrated to Turkey. Mine are from Ossetia, Meltem's from the Balkans. One day I went to Ossetia. I didn't feel much of a difference between the Ossetian customs there and those in Turkey until I climbed up the Caucasus Mountains. For the first time, I felt the feeling of I belong to the mountains. I could hear the mountains calling for me. The higher I climbed, the closer I became landscape. It was as if the wind was purifying me. The wind was sweeping away all restrictions, oppressions, all obligations, my feelings, my pain, my anger. It was as if I knew how to fly. The world diminishing when seen from the pinnacle, screams of the eagles, the roars of the cliffs. It was as if I knew how to fly. The mountains hit my heart as if I was under a spell. Eagles are the symbol of Ossetia. I wonder if Meltem's sense of feeling is anything like this. I wonder whether she was bewitched by the Welsh dragon as we came out of the station, the way I was by the Ossetian eagles. Can dragons put a spell on you?
Shall we go out and sit on the bench in front of the hotel?
It's after midnight.
So, what happens after midnight? Is there a curfew?
Of course there's no curfew, but for security reasons.
Security? Puna, what danger is there in the middle of the city?
No, don't say that. Anything can happen at this time of the night. Okay, we can go out to smoke, but promise me to only sit down on that bench. No walking anywhere.
Don't be ridiculous, Puna. It's fine.
You keep saying it's fine, but what if something happens? I mean, at this time of the night, look how dark the road opposite the bench is. It's pitch dark. There must be crackers there.
Cracker?
Yes, crackers. You know that those drug addicts. You never know what they're capable of doing.
Nobody can do anything in the middle of the street.
You know you've been a miscast, right? I mean, you're too fearless, always cold-blooded and stubborn. You also love adrenaline. On the other hand, I can't even stand the ideas that could risk my feeling of security. And you know how quickly I panic. And I hate adrenaline. We are a wrong match for this plot.
Have you ever found yourself looking towards the mountains from far away, lost? Have you ever felt the scent of the burning hay in your nostrils at the edge of the meadows, your hand between the hairs of a horse? Have you ever thought of your happy memories and heard nature calling? Have you ever let your emotions show with the whispers of the wind, standing far off from all the words you have been told, looking at your naked self in the mirror? Have you ever seen your reflection in your own eyes? Have you ever touched your skin, felt your simplicity with your own hand? And at that moment, hearing the land calling you for the first time.
Can't go back and change the beginning, but you can start where you are and change the ending. Flying with the boomerang and curving back to where I came from, it lands. The first time waft of frying bacon and mutton stewing in the black cast iron pot on the lava glow of the fire. The staccato laughter of men talking, mingling with kookaburras, calling like clowns. Inside, on the edge of my camp bed, I'm crying into my trying. Sudden and brutal is the sound of the kalapa, latching on to my left limb. Pale and shriveled with polio, 8 years old, and I taste the chill of its dull steel. Slim Dusty is singing from the record player, and our tin caravan is holding the fierce heat of the closing day. A lazy breeze from an open window accompanies the sun setting. I'm stumbling and struggling to stand with Mum holding my hand, and Dad is urging me towards him. You can do it. Don't let it beat you. You can do it. The first time, I'm standing on two legs and placing one foot in front of the other without the use of my wooden crutches. A marathon of 3 meters across the carpet of crimson swirl into his muscled arms. And he turns and guides me back towards Mum, and they're standing and laughing and clapping. The first time I'm walking. My left shoe, with an extra inch added, keeps my legs even. I fall, I rise, I keep walking. I fall, and I taste the punch of dust as I lurch up before the count of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. One day, I will run with the wild Brumbies. Faster and faster as the nights grow darker, I am the panther, crossing the ancient landscapes through turbulent rivers and over rippling dunes of ochre sand. I run. The wind is chasing me into the untamed wilderness, and I'm swerving and dazzling with the grace of the untouchable. I am the dreaming. Berlin, 55 degrees 51611 north, 13.376944 east. Your skin, sweet as toffee, is wearing a brown sheepskin jacket, a jacket of wool hacked and failing. The jacket that held us close beside your Kraken bike, which is now grey and broken in the darkness, lying by our road of wine and pale dust. 28 years, 2 months and 26 days of whisper wonder. We often cut our time short to stop and wander into the whispers hiding inside your jacket of secrets, now covered with dirt. Its dust rising and falling and rising with the failing of us in the winter darkness, and sometimes the lone moon shadowed us back to your bike. The first time I saw your Kraken bike pedaling the Lichtenberger Strasse, eyes wide with wonder, me back bent, heading into the darkness of Hausberger Strasse, hands thrust deep into my jacket before slipping on the black ice and failing, your hands quietly turning my face out of the snow dust. The outdoor cafe in the Volkspark, full of snow dust twinkling our faces, and you lay down your bike to sit beside me, with the light of failing snow falling into our unnamed place of wonder, and you wearing your brown sheepskin jacket. We walked to the cosmos to watch flickering fiction in the darkness. 28 years. 28 years of darkness, 2 months and 26 days before the dust rose from the beast, crumbling, your jacket watching and smiling and cheering with you holding the bike as the curved concrete beast bellowed. We did wonder what might there be after the failing. We pondered the failing, with my left hand tracing the back of your sheepskin jacket. We looked at each other with wonder, knowing that you too might become dust falling into the darkness, with me holding your grey Kraken bike. Hausberger Strasse. Your hands quietly turned my face out of the snow dust, pulsing with a life as vivid and complex as my own, tangled with the feeling of being out of place. Hand to face, vulnerable with ambiguous intensity, tasting the bitter sweetness of arriving into the future, our heart muscles knowing the plot of our lives might not matter anymore. Bodies abrupt and ready to lose everything in a fire. We give up trying to talk. Abandoning the hypothetical play in our heads, we gaze into the musty wistfulness of used bookshops in foreign cities. Drinking wine, listening to conversations, with everybody talking under a shadow of sadness. How long does it take to get to someone? We'll never know our history. Your hand turning my face out of the snow dust before I slipped into the ice fading of Hausberger Strasse. Hands thrust deep into my jacket, back bent, heading into the darkness. You pedaling back down Lichtenberger Strasse, your eyes wide with wonder. Returning home to the eerie, forlorn atmosphere of a place once bustling with people, now abandoned and quiet. I huddle with the amniotic tranquility of being indoors during a thunderstorm. You wrote to me of your father's voice. Goodbye. He kissed his closing face and left for home with tears streaming the dying. The first time kilo of hashish in a bag, your conversation with a police officer, you tasted fear and stayed cool. What might 5 years, prison years in Sydney be? A huge rock. Snort, zoom, wow of fool's gold. We're getting this lot from the cops. You all right with that? And you said, yeah. The first time you smelt a gun pointed, 5 meters close of shaking barrel. You surrendered. You were told. You did. Two men blamed, stripped, and beat you whilst discussing pushing a broom handle into your anus. The first time you overdosed, your friends calmed you, you cradling a broken bathroom door. They dragged you out and laid you down with your eyes closing. You thought, I might never wake. Kenya of the unknown, the white man nonsense of deepest, darkest Africa, fear in you. The first time you saw a man shot, walking away, white butcher's coat, back turned to the cop, bang, bang, bang. Get up, get up. He'll get up soon. And then you knew he'd never. A man beaten to death by mob justice on the streets of Nairobi. The ugly animal resides, and you will never stand by again. You seized the jaws of the demented and the bloodthirsty, and you walked him out of the circled, shouting crowd. You walked the mean Nairobi night, powerful and safe with gang members, into a slum of decrepit humanity, enduring and surviving, realizing we all want the same. The first time you saved a drowning man will try to take you down. You took control. Your baby's head birthing out into the world. You're a small part of the huge for the first time.
Smert na tretjem etage. Death on the third floor, Russia, winter 1998. Iruki imuka, Iruki imuka. Have we arrived? No, we haven't arrived. 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 The songs we sang to disguise, to forget the pangs of hunger consuming us. Two officers in a patrol car. Astanavit! Astanavit! Officers. Oi, Churni! Stop! Yaskazal, stop! Yupta, you're mad. Oi, stop, I said. Your mother. Two officers got out of their Land Rover and started punching us in the stomach. You see, we had spent all day loading and offloading goods in North Moscow at Richskaya Market. We were bundled into the back of a police car and driven to the back end of the market. Officer, o vas geroin yest? O vas geroin yest? Have you got any heroin? Have you got any heroin? Officer, Boje moi, yashas o vas vrotam. O vas dingi yest? Pakajit minya svoy karman. Yas kazal, pakajit minya svoy karmani. Pakaji. Покажи меня свой карман. Пожалуйста, пожалуйста, пожалуйста. They took our money and our shoes and abandoned us behind the markets. Abandoned us. Officer, иди нахуй, я сказал, иди нахуй. Go to hell, I said. Go to hell. We used cardboard boxes. We made shoes. Dexterous. We jumped onto an overground train, hoping there were no ticket inspectors. As soon as the train left the station, we were stopped and handed over to the traffic police. Johnson was panicking. This was how we lost one of our friends, Fossack William. He was arrested for dodging tickets. When checks were conducted, they found he was illegal. He was deported back to Cameroon. Not us, though. We spent that night and all day at the station. We were given plenty of churni kleb, black bread, and a warm cup of tea every hour, one of life's little pleasantries. As we left the station, I placed my right hand on Johnson's shoulder. The duty officers looked at us. He shook his head and shouted, "You banagelu boy, idi nahui, fucking gays, go to hell." We laughed, we sang, "Iruki." Imuka, Iruki, Imuka, Iruki, Imuka, Iruki, Imuka. Have we arrived? No, we haven't arrived. 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 The hostel was quiet. In fact, extremely quiet. No guards at the entrance. No guards at the reception. Lift near a bow tight. There was a note. Slowly we walked up. onto the third floor. It was quiet. No up and down movements, none. Music from Peter's room was not loud enough. Strange, around this time, everyone would have been back from their daily routines of running away from the police, working at the market. People would be popping from room to rooms in search for food whilst engaging in unnecessary conversation. "Yo, brother," I said to Johnson, "make I wash, then we will go buy head cow for make pepper soup." Johnson went towards Atabong's room while I went and knocked on Jume's door. I knocked on the door and Ebong opened the door. He held his head down. There was no eye contact. Strange, because Ebong would normally greet, share some bread, and talk about all the verbal racism he suffered at the bakery. Not today. As I entered the room, it was like a court chambers. Curtains drawn down. Jume was talking with Teresa, Bate, Joe Kafu, Nguese, were the judge, jury, and executioner. Without any warning, Joe Kafu ran from the back of the room and headbutted me, point blank. As I went onto the floor, there was a flurry of kicks and stampede on my ribs, my buttocks, my neck. I laid in a fetal position, protecting my face. Nguese and Joe brought me back up and dragged me into the bathroom. Joe had been nominated as the ringleader. He demanded for me to take off all my clothes. I said I would not, but I joined them, and between the three of them, I was stripped right down to my boxer shorts. I was placed on the stool in the middle of the room. People took turns in punching me. The whole noise brought Grand Usher Hope, who was in tears. Johnson was crying. Frederick Atabong pleaded on my behalf, but it was on deaf ears. There was no way they could intervene. My worst fear occurred when Divine went and bought a crate of Baltica Deviatka, Baltica 9. I knew the combination of alcohol would only make matters worse, and it did. Joan Kafu and Kwese brought out two knives and placed them on top of a cooker and waited. Divine smashed his bottle of Baltica 9 and rushed forward towards me, but he was held and pinned back by Johnson. William Fosak had red blood eyes. Grace could not bear looking at me. She dreaded my face. We made brief eye contact before she left. Every time Joan Kafu Onkwese landed a blow, the whole room cheered. This is how mad Pechatniki got. The people who were punching me and beating me up were only doing so because they were guaranteed sexual favors, small meals, a sleeping space, nothing else. Then the torture began. Once the knives were red hot from the cooker, Joe and Nguese took it in turns, placing the knives on my body. First, they started with the back of my neck. You know the noise that comes when fish or meat is placed into a heated frying pan? Well, that was a noise from the back of my neck. The knife was stuck. I did not move, just in case, because I was tempted to start cutting my neck. Once the knife was getting cold, it would be returned onto the fire, and the next hot knife would be placed along various parts of my body. All in all, I was burned on my neck, my back, my knees, my ankle. Nguese stabbed me on my right knee. The whole room smelled of burning flesh. The smell of burnt human flesh is not that different from goat meat or roasted pig. As the alcohol flowed, the torture continued. Some will say, just kill him and get over with. Divine and Teresa were the leaders in this chorus. Every time the knife was placed on my body, my thoughts would drift to Akabate Julius. How scared he must have been during his last moment here on earth, knowing that he wasn't even guilty of his crime. Those that he was being tortured for, the fear in his eyes, knowing that death was approaching. I wasn't feeling any pain. I don't know. I must have had an out-of-body experience. But they would run from a distance and punch my face as the whole room cheered. Ngweso will run from a distance and punch my face. The whole room cheered. Yes, Joe Kafu was the chief executioner. Whatever he did, the rest of the gang followed. Jume and his girlfriend took turns in spitting and slapping me. Again, when the knives were red hot enough, they would then place them on various parts of my body. Yes, people were getting excited. Some were even turned on, and I mean sexually, by my torture. I saw Divine kissing his girlfriend passionately. Jume had Teresa pinned against the wall in passionate embrace. I thought about my mother, and that Bakuri song came to my head. Agbe wolo atimbangundu, agbe wolo atimbangundu, weye oma weya weya njei, weya oma moka kangwema. Your children, you brought them here, but they died, and you are returning to your maker empty-handed. Weye oma weya weya njei, weya oma moka kangwema. You are crying, but for which of your children are you crying for? Just pull yourself together. So that day, I prayed in a tongue I did not know, in a language I did not understand. I laughed. Rain bouncing on my back, my ring was hiding the passage of time. Living as a stranger amongst my own, I cry. I do not remember my dreams. The sun rays avoid my skin. My shoes have holes. I paid my debts 1,000 times to those who plan to kill me. I laugh. This is my grave. This is my grave. I stand here in a field of daffodils. I am waiting for you. I am waiting for you to bury me. Thank you very much.
This was the first in our series of chapter reading podcasts. Watch this space for new episodes.